All right, everyone. Welcome back to the show. Today, we're here to discuss something which I had flagged up as something we really did need to talk about urgently back in late 2016 at some point, and we kept putting it off and off. And now that the second season has taken the world by storm, I think the time has finally come. So we are here, of course, to talk about Fleabag. And to do that, I'm joined by the foremost Phoebe Waller-Bridge superfan that I know, Amy, making a return appearance. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm glad to be here as the number one Phoebe Waller-Bridge fan, and to, you know, not be a weakie and come back to podcast.
There is a lot of competition for that title now, but back when the show was first on my radar and your radar, it felt like it was almost like a cult sensation, right? There weren't too many people talking about it, but the people who were raving about it. So the volume was still out there.
It's true. And I kind of miss those days. Instead, every time I get on Twitter, especially today on Father's Day, people keep tweeting about the hot priest. And I just wasn't prepared for that.
Also, not on Father's Day, people are tweeting incessantly about the hot priest. And I'm sure that will die down eventually, but we are right in hot priest summer at the moment. And it shows no sign of abating soon. And I know a few months ago when it had released on BBC America, which as a exiled Brit, I can't watch anymore. So I had to dig around the internet looking for links. We were watching it then, and there was some discussion by the people who were watching it and so on. And then one day, a few months later, I go on Twitter and my entire timeline is full of people just yelling incoherently about the hot priest. And it's like, okay, well, I guess it's finally released then. I guess we're all now on the same page at long last.
Yeah, I'm curious why there was so much more talk about the second season than the first season. I don't know if it's because of Phoebe Waller-Bridge becoming more of a household name with Killing Eve and being in Star Wars and all of that. But I'm not sure when people started catching on to the brilliance of the show.
Well, let's go back to that origin story then. What was it that kind of clued you into the brilliance of the show and made you the first Phoebe Waller-Bridge super fan that I knew of?
I don't know how I came to the show, but the first, 23 minutes were probably the funniest TV that I had ever seen, and kind of immediately drew me in. Just the very first, the first 3 to 5 minutes is just basically a setup for a joke. The way that she, tells the joke and narrates the story is so funny. And she's doing, the sort of the camera pans and whatnot isn't, super original or anything, but the way that she looks at the camera, the way she glances at what feels like, you or the audience is just so fresh that I was immediately drawn in and felt connected to the character and wanted to know more about her, why she was the way that she was and what sort of adventure she was going to get into, which I think was, very intentional. And the way that she sort of evolves over the series is so brilliant that you just stay with her the whole time.
Yeah, that first episode, and even just the first few minutes of that episode, definitely catch your attention and refuse to let go. I think it would have snared people in regardless. But I think it's almost easier the way the show is set up too, where nowadays there are so many good shows that basically any new show gets a one-episode audition. And if you don't like it, then it's really hard to convince yourself to trudge through and stick with it. So it helps a lot if that show really has a good sense of what it is and what it's trying to do from the outset. And if that first episode can set a high standard that the rest continue to follow, and this one definitely does. And I don't know how much of that is because Phoebe Waller-Bridge is just so like intimately involved with every part of the show that it's going to be quintessentially hers from the outset, but regardless, like, it definitely makes a strong case of itself early, and it's hard to ignore it after that.
Right, and I think that it has the benefit of having been performed by her on stage before it was made into a TV show, which probably means that it went through many rounds of changes, and she really is the entirety of the show. There's not really anyone else contributing to it beyond, I guess, the actors and the director, but it's completely her. She gets to tell the story that she wants to tell. And there's not many shows that have, one person's hand all the way through it.
And that stage show, I think, is a sign of how far things have come, because I believe it started as just a fringe show back in 2013, 2014, if that sounds about right. And then when it was picked up for TV a few years later, people didn't really know who Phoebe Waller-Bridge was at that point. And when that one woman show was there, and you could still find tickets. You know, that was a thing you could realistically do. And then when it was revived between the first and second season, it was just impossible. Like the moment that they went on sale, everything was sold out, and there was a think piece a few months ago that got a lot of people upset on Twitter. Something to the effect of Fleabag is only for posh girls. And that seemed very redundant to me, but the one sense it's true in is only posh girl could maybe afford a ticket to the Fleabag stage show and its revival with how insane the prices were getting. Because people had caught on at that point. The secret was out. This was no longer a cult sensation. It was just a sensation.
I don't know. I wouldn't consider myself a posh girl, and I probably would have paid an arm and a leg to see that show live. So.
Not very initiative. Just, you know, just commenting on the commentary, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so that... As far as I know, the stage show is, I guess, the TV show is faithful to the stage show rather than the other way around. But there are some differences in there, because I've heard reports from people who went to see that back in the day that it was a lot darker than the TV show ended up being, which sounds kind of difficult to do with how grim the plot could get at times. But things like Hillary dies at one point in the stage show, not to spoil it for anyone in case it comes back for a third run. And there's a lot of just... stuff which I guess works better in the context of a stage show than a TV show, but you can definitely see the seeds being sown for what we saw later on, I guess.
That makes sense to me, just because it was a one-woman show, and so much of the humor within the TV show comes from her interactions with other people. So I imagine that would be harder to do when she's just sort of monologuing through the show.
I do wonder how we get from Phoebe Waller-Bridge back then struggling to make a name for herself to where we are now, because there are a lot of talented actors and writers and producers out there who are, you know, slaving away on their own fringe shows, and maybe 1 in 100 of them will get picked up and get a chance at, you know, serious stardom. And from what we've seen with Phoebe Waller-Bridge, she is talented enough that she was going to catch people's eyes at some point anyway. But I don't know if that's meant to be like a reassuring story that she put on a great show and she's great at what she does, and so she's risen to greatness, or if it's kind of dispiriting, where it's like there could be lots of Phoebe Waller-Bridges out there whose shows we desperately want to see and we just might never get that chance.
I guess for me, her writing stands out even amongst all other TV shows, that it's more that the talent rose to the top rather than she just got lucky. But maybe that's just my wishful thinking.
What is it about the writing that really strikes a chord with you then?
I think the way that it is able to flip back and forth between just being utterly hilarious to emotionally destroying you very quickly and then just bounces back. And it's very intentional. I feel like every line is delivered to tell the audience something or to express the emotion of a character or to give us like important information. There's nothing that really goes to waste. Especially within the context of a show that's so short. It's only, you know, less than half an hour. And you feel the depth of the characters, the depth of their experience and all of that. That's really, to me, a testament both to the performances, but more so to the writing.
Yeah, and I guess that goes back to what I was saying before, where a lot of shows take a little bit of time to ease in and find their stride. And with a show that's this short, you really don't have time to do that, right? Like if the first episode or two falls flat, then that's a third of your season that you can't get back. So that places a pretty tough challenge on any writer who's working within that constraint, and she definitely rises to meet that challenge. And we were saying off air about having rewatched a series in preparation, and also because we just want to rewatch Fleabag, because why wouldn't you? Right. And you do pick up a lot of stuff on a rewatch, which to an extent that's true of every show, where you see things which, with the benefit of hindsight, do strike you as foreshadowing. But with Fleabag in particular, none of it feels like it was kind of shoehorned in there, or that it's like unsubtle. It just feels like part of a very kind of tight, cohesive package, if that makes sense.
Yes, it's very, very deliberate.
Do you think that also extends to some of her other work? So she had a lot of acclaim recently for her role in the first season, at least, of Killing Eve. The second season, I mean, maybe no need to talk about as much. But the first season, at least, you can definitely see the paw prints of Phoebe Waller-Bridge in there at various points. And the demands there are fairly different, because she's not writing a character for herself. She's writing it for an incredible actress, but someone else who has to embody that role. And then also, it's more of an ensemble cast, right? Even though it's about some of the titular characters, it's not a one-woman show in quite the same way. So do you feel like she has had to like adapt her writing style at all with that in mind, or is she just kind of taking the same approach and I guess still having success with it?
I think that she had success with it, but the way that it's written is clearly not, she's not the only voice in the room. And I think that's unfortunate because she isn't, she's just not, she shouldn't be on a team. Like, she should be the leader. That's my sort of opinion on Killing Eve. There's parts that are so well written and the story is well told, but there's a lot that sort of doesn't make sense, especially towards the end, or that just sort of, I don't know, didn't quite work with me in the way that Fleabag did, where everything does feel very intentional and deliberate. Killing Eve sort of has a more loose feel to it, which was very fun, but I prefer probably her writing for herself rather than writing for another character. But I also think that that's one of her first experiences really doing that. So taking that into consideration, writing such a successful show, you know, she did kind of hit it out of the park in that sense.
Yeah, it is, I guess, kind of fun to think that this might be the beginning of a long and storied career in film and TV, right? And in 20 years time, we'll have an entire like catalog of award-winning work that she's done that we can go back and enjoy again. But I guess in Killing Eve's case too, there's the issue of she's writing for another character, but she's also writing for another character based on someone else's existing writing. And so she doesn't have maybe the same creative freedom that you do when you write your own one-woman stage show and then that gets sent out to the big screen. But I know with Killing Eve in particular, there was, I would say, definitely a shift between season one and season two. And a lot of people have attributed that to Phoebe Waller-Bridge leaving the show, or at least not being the steady hand on the tiller to guide things anymore. When you heard that Fleabag was coming back for a second season, I imagine you were thrilled, first of all, but were you also a little bit concerned that it might run into that same issue that a lot of shows have, where they're great for one season, but they don't really need to come back for another season? And when they do, you don't really recapture the same magic that you had the first time.
Right. I was so excited, I didn't even like consider the fact that it might not live up to my expectations.
It's just a more optimistic mindset, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I just felt like I could trust her to tell the story of Fleabag. And she feels like she took her time with it, which I think is why I felt more optimistic. It wasn't just that the first season had so much success that they, you know, kind of pressured her into doing another one. And she just went into it and did it. Like, she made sure that it was just as good, if not better, than the first season, and really carried forth the humor and the emotion of the first season, which is rare. But I think also considering the fact that it's a quick show. It's just a few episodes long, and you can really watch it in one sitting, that I felt confident that she could, you know, come up with 2.5 hours of good work.
And she did. I think we can all agree on that much at least. Yeah. But had that not happened, had we just ended things with Fleabag season one, would that have felt complete to you? Like, would that have been, because the ending kind of leaves it open, right? Where the ending of the season is literally her signing a loan application form. But when you phrase it that way, it doesn't sound, it doesn't really make much sense. But in the context of everything else, where she's able to just like buckle down and focus on something just practical and sensible and move on with her life, it kind of fits together neatly. But if we had stopped there, would that have been a satisfying end to that story for you? Or was there still more that had to be said?
I mean, there was so much more that I wanted to know about the character, but at the same time, I think that it would have been satisfying because sort of the arc of the season is resolved. She's finally sort of at least facing the fact that she is grieving the loss of her friend and dealing with the guilt that she is a part of it, and sort of admitting, at least to the audience and to her family, that she, you know, isn't this put together person that she's sort of claiming to be, and sort of her facing that fact, even though it's sort of heartbreaking, you kind of understand that she might be okay. She's sort of given a sense of something to hold on to and to hope for when the loan manager person, whatever his name is, sort of gives her a second chance with the cafe. You sort of, it's sort of a symbol of things are going to be okay and she's going to be able to move on. So I think that I know that it was originally sort of intended to be one season. You know, that would have been satisfying for me, but I'm glad that they decided to bring it back anyways.
Yeah, and going into that second season, if there is, I guess there are several differences, but one of them that really stands out is you have the Fleabag universe, if you like, expanding, where in the first season, a lot of these characters who still played a big role, and it felt more like an ensemble cast for a show which is all about one character and named after that one character and heavily stars that one character. It's still great to see, like, Claire and the godmother and all of these other people who play this rich and interesting role in the story. In the second season, it feels like they really have their own subplots, for lack of a better word. Like, they become part of the narrative in a way that in season one, they are, but only kind of in Fleabag's peripheral vision.
Yes, which I think was so great, because those characters, despite her being the star of the show in season one, you still do sort of understand the characters and their motivations and at least how they relate to her sort of clues us into who they are as people. So it was really exciting to sort of see that expanded on, especially, I think, her sister and her dad. The last episode of the series, really, you kind of get a little bit more insight into what motivates him, because he's sort of a closed off character throughout the entirety of the series, someone who sort of clearly is not emotionally available and unhappy, but not really able to talk about it. And so having a little bit more, you know, just within like a 3-minute scene, you feel you see him as a really dynamic character with an interesting backstory, and I don't know, it just helps to sort of give us even more insight into why Fleabag is the way that she is.
Yeah, and I think it's worth getting into some of those relationships later on, but one of them that doesn't feature as heavily for obvious reasons in season two is Fleabag and Boo, who is this, in the first season she's kind of the center of this mystery or this question that's looming over the entire season. And then when that gets resolved in the finale, when we get to season two, we skip it almost a year, and Boo is rarely mentioned except in these occasional flashbacks or references. And it's never made quite clear, and I think this is smart, whether she has processed her own guilt over that properly and she's accepted the loss and she's moving on, or if she's just burying that and trying to find other ways to compensate for it and is trying not to mention it however she can.
Yeah, it's really not made clear, which I think makes it a little bit hard, because you know at the end of season one that she's been sort of hiding that, her role in Boo's death, from the audience. And sort of when she comes to terms with it at the end, you sort of think that it's going to be this step towards progression, but then in the second season it's clear that she's still kind of unable to talk about it, and it's still a big pain point in her life, but it sort of ends up being what I guess builds the connection between her and the priest in a way, at least in the sense that he's trying to sort of get to know her in the same way that the audience is kind of trying to get to know her and understand her and why she is the way that she is. And the fact that, I guess, the audience is still as sort of unclear as to how she's dealt with this sort of clues us into maybe what the priest is thinking.
Yeah, and it's a weird tension too, because you want her to have moved on and to be happy, and she seems to be happier at least, but you don't want that to just be like a mask for something to express, and that it's just like getting like buried down in a very Claire-like fashion instead. And it's kind of unclear which of those it is. Instead of talking about her being like Claire, let's just talk about Claire, though, because I think Claire is fascinating. I think that relationship between the two of them is one of the things that really makes the show tick. And it's, I think like a defining feature of Claire's in general, that that's more about Fleabag than it is about Claire, if that makes sense. I don't know. I have this theory, which I put out there before, that everyone exists on this spectrum between Fleabag and Claire. And, you know, you have people who typically the Claires want to be Fleabags and the Fleabags don't want to be Claires. And then there are people in between who are kind of hard to define. And I don't know how much use this scale actually has, but it's an interesting way of thinking about the world, at least.
Yes, you shared that with me, and I've thought about it a lot afterwards, especially when rewatching it, and just find it, well, first off, I don't know if it's true, but the idea of being a Claire just sounds so stressful to me that I can't even begin to like reflect on my own self to, I just have to automatically choose Fleabag because I don't want to be a Claire so
badly.
That sounds
very Claire-like though. That's Claire-ish behavior.
Avoiding, yes, probably, but really that's both of them. But yeah, I think that when the first episode starts of season two and she pans to the camera and says the season is a love story, my first thought was that it was going to be about her and Claire, because at the end of season one they sort of have a falling out where, you know, Fleabag has been pretty anti-Martin, her terrible husband, and tells, you know, shares with Claire that he tried to make a move on her. And you kind of think that Claire might come to her senses and leave him. And instead, you know, she ends up siding with him over her. And it's, you know, devastating because Claire, despite the fact that they are completely different and, you know, probably if it wasn't the connection to, you know, their mom, they wouldn't even be, you know, in each other's life. And she's one of the few people that Fleabag really still loves in any way. So I kind of thought that this season was going to be more about their connection. And it probably is the second most important relationship of the season. But obviously, I think the love refers to the hot priest.
I don't know. There could be room for a spin-off series about the Claire and Claire love story, which has been, you know, blossoming the whole time. I would watch that. I don't know if it would get quite the same reviews, but, you know, anything in the extended universe, I'm here for.
Yeah, that sounds, once again, stressful to me.
I don't know. I feel like if the idea of being a Claire is so stressful, then you end up in like this stress spiral where that then confirms your own Claireness, and that stresses you out even more, and it really becomes tough to get out of. But the difference between the two of them, I think, is so not well articulated, because I think kind of what makes it work is that it never really is articulated, except when Claire is snapping a Fleabag over something. But there's always just this fundamental difference there, which they have to coexist, but they can't coexist peacefully. And I think they both inhabit those characters very well. Like, it's tough to imagine anyone else in the role of Fleabag too. Mm-hmm. But Charlotte Clifford is fantastic as Claire. And I think there are lots of Claires out there more than there are Fleabags, but Charlotte Clifford is particularly good. You can tell, I was going to say you can tell why she was chosen for the role. She was chosen because Phoebe Waller-Bridge just wanted to have all her friends there with her, right? In like the best form of nepotism possible. But Sean Clifford rises to the challenge. I mean, she's fantastic.
Yeah, she's so amazing. I think that the biggest difference I see between the two of them is how they both handle their like grief and unhappiness in different but like equally unhealthy ways, where Claire is sort of buries herself at work and sort of accepts her, I guess, unhappiness with her family and her husband and just sort of decides to deal with it, whereas Fleabag's sort of appalled by all of it and just sort of pokes fun at it and, you know, sort of uses, I guess she's sort of like, I guess, hedonistic in a way in her pursuits to sort of numb her pain. And those two things are both probably equally unhealthy, yet one of them is much more outwardly so and much more probably frowned upon in Fleabag's case, whereas, you know, burying yourself in work in at least U.S. culture is sort of a positive thing to do.
Right. Claire responds in a much more traditionally professional way, mm-hmm. whereas Fleabag is a little more irresponsible, but just the nature of who Fleabag is, her irresponsibility, I think, is seen as more like cool or fun, mm-hmm. Whereas Claire, you know, this is the kind of big difference between the two of them, right? Like, Fleabag is never going to look like a pencil. You know, she's always going to, even if she's having a bad hair day, it's always going to come across in a way that's like fun or edgy or dramatic. Whereas Claire just, she's never going to be the cool kid in the room. And she knows that. And I think it eats away at her.
Yeah. And that's because she is essentially jealous that Fleabag's allowed to be irresponsible and basically gets away with all of it, because that's probably ideally who she would like to be.
Right. As Claire says, Fleabag will always be fine. She'll always be interesting with her quirky cafe and her dead best friend. And she just makes her feel like she's failed. And that's a kind of very vulnerable moment for Claire, like uncharacteristically so, but I think part of what makes that relationship so dysfunctional is that Fleabag is the one person who can kind of get under her skin in that way and make her feel vulnerable and kind of needle her into giving those confessions. Whereas Fleabag herself, for as much as she is a hot mess on the inside, remains very kind of composed a lot of the time.
It's true, but in the same way, it's not always to Claire. She does this with other characters, but she kind of goes from, you know, completely sarcastic to complete emotional breakdown as well. She doesn't really have, neither of them really have an in-between.
That's true. But one exception to that maybe is with the audience, which is one of the more important relationships of the show. It's her with the people who are beyond that fourth wall. And it's a pretty common dramatic device to break the fourth wall like that. We've seen it time and time again, but something feels different about it in Fleabag. It feels like it's being used in a more kind of intimate or inventive way, even if I can't quite pinpoint why.
Yeah, no, exactly. It feels, you really do feel connected to the character. And I think the fact that the way they use the audience as the season progresses, it evolves, and that's rare. Like, that's very innovative, especially I think the contrast between the first and second season in particular is really striking. In the second season, it's sort of acknowledged by her and by other characters, which is very original.
Yeah, the moment the priest catches Fleabag talking to the audience for the first time, it feels like you got caught too, almost. It's like there's some sudden change in a relationship that you didn't even know you were in, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. And even when she mentions it to, when she's in therapy and she sort of says, oh no, I have friends, and then looks at us and winks, and it's like the first time she's acknowledging that she knows we're there, even though she's, you know, looking at us throughout the series. It's sort of like, oh, she knows I'm here and I'm allowed to be here and I'm allowed to like be witnessing this. And you feel a little bit like, I think at that point is when I knew that this was going to be used in a different way. And I loved it when the priest sort of interrupted her and called her out for what she was doing. Because you're sort of aware throughout the first season that she turns to us not only to narrate, but also to sort of break free from the moments that she's in and sort of give herself a little bit of a distance from the people that she's with to sort of tell us what she's actually thinking or to, guess what a character is going to say next, to sort of allow us to see how predictable she thinks people are and how well she knows them. And then that sort of totally shifts in the second season.
Yeah, in that first season, it starts off as this very convenient narrative device where we get to learn who the characters are and maybe some of the necessary context, where it feels like we're being let in on the joke instead of it just being fed to us. So she'll turn to the audience and mention who someone is and, you know, what their deepest, darkest secret is, just as a way of contextualizing things. But then beyond that, it does become this odd confessional style of thing. And then in the second season, is there some kind of shift, do you think, there too? Because I know Phoebe Waller-Bridge said in the first season, it was more of like, hey, look at this, I'm letting you into my life. You can kind of revel in the same debauchery that I'm getting up to. And then in the second season, there's more of like a kind of guilty, intimate quality to it, where you're getting to see more of who she is and maybe less of what she's doing.
Yeah, I think towards the end, she sort of lets her – the end of season one, she lets her guard down, right? She's sort of been keeping her, I guess, culpability in her friend's death from the audience. And once that's sort of revealed and she kind of cracks, we're just sort of there. We are her friends. We see her for who she really is. And I think in the second season, it's you feel less like she's performing for you and more like you're in a way, like almost her crutch, like she's dependent on us to kind of get through some of these situations. And, you know, that clearly sort of hinders her ability to really connect with other people.
Yeah, that doesn't feel like a healthy relationship either, right? Because in the first season, we learned that Boo was basically her only friend and she lost Boo through her own actions. And now we have to collectively have to kind of fill the void, I guess. But that's a very one-sided thing where she's unloading all of this stuff onto us, and she's able to do that because we can't really respond, right? We can't challenge her on anything or force her to pry into the underlying causes or anything. We're just kind of a repository for her secrets and emotions.
Yeah, we're very convenient for her. And yeah, that's why I love the scene when she goes to therapy and she's, you know, being her sarcastic, sort of pessimistic self, but sort of, I don't know, arming herself through her humor, and the therapist kind of sees right through her and tells her that she's like, you know, I can't remember the exact words, but along the lines of you're a heartless person with no friends, you know, by your own words. And she sort of like stares at her like, oh, she's on to me, you know, which is sad. And it's, you know, I mean, then she obviously connects it back to the audience and us being her friend. But you can see that she's still, despite having like come to terms with the loss of Boo, she's still, for some reason, not really able to move forward and, you know, connect with people.
So when she finally gets some kind of closure with Boo at the end of the first season, we have a parallel thing at the end of season two where she, the last scene we ever see of Fleabag is her walking away and waving goodbye to the camera and waving goodbye to us. And that feels like more satisfactory closure than most characters get at the end of most shows, right? Like that's almost the ideal ending where she doesn't need us anymore and she can move on and maybe has learned enough to be independent again, almost.
Yeah, I think that was, I mean, both to symbolize the fact that the series is ending, but more importantly that she, through the season, learned to love and doesn't need to rely on us anymore to be there.
I think it's more definitive too, right? Because we've seen some shows where when they get renewed for another season, they have to find ways to like bring characters back from the dead or pretend that they never died the entire time or invent some incredible plot contrivance to have them meet up where they really shouldn't be meeting up or stuff like that. Whereas just Fleabag waving goodbye and walking into the distance feels like there's no way you can unlock that door again. Like that's it. There's, you know, you break the premise of the show if you ever revisit that.
Yeah, no, completely. I think that was her way of saying, don't try to make me milk any more out of this character because I've, you know, she's given me enough and I'm ready to do other things.
And yeah, she has bigger and better things to move on to now, but I think Fleabag will always be remembered as like the springboard, I guess, the thing which, you know, when we're looking back, hopefully on a long and storied career, however many years hence, that's going to be the thing that really like shot her into that stratosphere.
Yeah, I'm really nervous about what she does next. I mean, I know she's writing the James Bond movie, which personally I find to be a waste of her talents. and I'm just sort of afraid that she's going to be gobbled up by, I don't know, Hollywood, instead of, you know, just given the freedom to do whatever she wants to do. And like she did with Fleabag, like there's so many, I feel like, opportunities for her to be able to do that with, you know, where we are in television these days. But I feel like she's sort of jumped over that into these bigger productions.
I have to think she can write her own ticket essentially at this point. I would hope so at least. And that she seems like someone who does have clear priorities in mind and does value those and want to stick to those. And will not be swallowed up by the machine as easily as some others would. Not that that's a bad thing necessarily. You know, if you see a chance at career success, you may as well take it. But I think she wants that to be on her own terms, and she's going to get to choose what those terms are.
Yeah, and I think she'll do whatever she wants to do. And, you know, if she's going to make a lot of money doing this and then gets to go do whatever she, like, truly wants to do, then great, that's fine by me, as long as she sort of returns to where I believe her, like, voice can really be heard, which doesn't feel like James Bond is the right mechanism for that.
But she seems like she isn't really embracing any kind of, like, public celebrity life either, right? Where I know she said in recent interviews she still feels strange whenever, like, a fan comes up to her on the street or on the subway and wants to take a picture or something. Like, that's not, she just hasn't, like, assimilated into that mindset yet, and she doesn't have, like, some massive Twitter following. She's not doing all of these public events. She's very much still just being her own person, doing her own thing, even if that's necessarily more in the spotlight than it was previously.
Yeah, no, that's very true, and I respect her a lot for that. Even just, like, the few interviews that she hasn't done, that many interviews, and the few interviews that she's done are very short. She's always very much talking about the shows. There's not all that much, like, information on her personal life out there.
How easy do you think it is to separate her as herself, as Phoebe Waller-Bridge, from the character of Fleabag? Because when you're writing this one woman show, which becomes an ensemble cast, and there are definitely, like, it is weird to think that if that foundation was removed, if Fleabag wasn't there anymore, you would still happily watch a show about Claire or Martin, or even just, like, the therapist, right? Just any excuse to have Fiona Shaw back on your screen. But that, she is the central character. She gets to write that character and everything else that's going on to and around that character. And so it feels impossible for it to not be a reflection of herself in some way. But I don't know how extreme that really is.
Right, right. You have to think that it's, I don't know. Maybe she, I think that if it were me and I was writing a show, I would not put, I don't know, so much of myself into a character. And I, from the interviews that I've listened to with her, it sounds like she drew a lot from her friends and what other people were saying and thought it was interesting, so sort of put it into the character. So I think that there's certainly elements of her, you know, within the character, and it's really hard to not see her as Fleabag.
Is that because you're a Claire and Claires don't like to write themselves into...
I'm not a Claire. Stop insulting me.
I take your point, though, I think. It's weird because she, as we said, does seem to remain fairly private. Fleabag is not a private character in any sense of the word, really, just necessarily, and also by the, like, central conceit of the show. So if you are turning a window on your, turning, like, a mirror on yourself, it's a very weird way to do it, like, on this big international stage. But I don't know, because Phoebe Waller-Bridge herself seems very, like, enigmatic almost, right? There's this sort of mysterious quality to her, where there are some people who, like, in Hollywood, who remain fairly private, but that's fine. Like, no one really cares to ask any questions. But with her, it's like the fact that she's remaining so mysterious just gets people more curious, if anything.
That's true. I think the fact that she performed this one-woman play and wrote this character requires so much vulnerability, which the character of Fleabag rarely is able to show, which makes me feel like she's very, I don't know, maybe she's like the healthy version of Fleabag. Like she's the version that has healed and moved on and evolved. But, you know, the character is very emotionally distant and not, I guess she's like somewhat reflective, but sort of pushes it away and doesn't really face her issues. So it's hard to think that someone who writes a character that sharply would also be that person in real life. Like the actual Fleabag would probably not write about herself.
She wouldn't be able to be that introspective, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Or she wouldn't be able to openly admit to being that person.
Yeah, because I know there's some discussion around how, like, relatable the character of Fleabag is. And I don't think she's meant to be especially relatable, but there's certainly a thing where, like, people do or don't want to relate to Fleabag, but you don't know how much of that is just really liking Phoebe Waller-Bridge and wanting to relate to her instead. And then if you do drill down into that with the character herself, maybe there's a thing where it's like, I pulled a quote here from someone saying, quote, when your life is such a mess, it's actually fun to watch a havoc of someone else's. And so you see Fleabag, who's working through all of this own personal drama, and it's a good way to reassure yourself about your own, maybe. But there's, from the other direction, you also see this thing where, like, it's almost chic to pretend that you're more dysfunctional and disordered than you really are. And maybe that's part of it too, that, like, you're not actually a Fleabag, but you kind of want to be a Fleabag because that's a cool thing to pretend to be.
Yes, absolutely. The sort of rise of people liking to call themselves or refer to themselves as a hot mess. I think that where Fleabag is very relatable to most people, though, is just in so many moments where she's dealing with certain emotions or certain experiences where the character just, what she does is very, very human and feels very, very real, even if it's not necessarily how you would, I don't know, react. The way that she deals with things feels so human, and that is very relatable.
Mm-hmm. And going back to those family dynamics then, we've spoken a bit about that tension between Fleabag and Claire, but the parents are, former and current parents are looming large over this as well. And Olivia Colman as their kind of stepmother-to-be is fantastic. And she's, in the same way as Martin almost, she's a perfect villain without crossing the line in like an obviously villainous way. She's just like a really mean, terrible person, but with that like plausible deniability where any one thing she says, she can excuse as, oh, well, I was just being nice or I was just being polite or whatever. She can always find some excuse for it.
Yeah, she's an absolute monster in like a butterfly costume. Like she just floats around making passive aggressive comments and undermining Fleabag at every opportunity. And would you rather have to have an hour-long conversation with the godmother or with Martin? Because I actually might pick Martin. The godmother is so wretched.
That's interesting. I feel like Martin's wretchedness is hard to ignore, whereas at least with the godmother, you can smile and kind of go along with it and try and just pretend it's not happening, whereas Martin is just really in your face about it.
It's true, but I'd rather somewhat, at least he's like more self-aware to the fact that he's like an asshole rather than pretending to be a saint.
Okay, so that's interesting, because you hear that line a lot, that, well, at least he knows he's an asshole, he's playing a character or whatever, but does that actually make things better? Like,
it doesn't make him a better person.
No.
It makes him slightly more tolerable,
I guess, but he's like weaponizing his own self-awareness to have an excuse to be a bad person. Like that's not encouraging, right? That's not making me want to pick Martin over the godmother here.
It's true, but at least we don't have to pretend. Pretending is so awful.
Yeah, well let's talk about Martin quickly, because that completely dysfunctional relationship with Claire is one of the more uncomfortable things to watch on the show, and one of the more triumphal moments is in that season 2 finale when she finally decides to leave him for good. And his breakdown as a response to that is also incredibly compelling. What did you make of just that dynamic between the two of them across the two seasons?
Oh, that relationship was very confusing to me in a lot of ways. I didn't really understand why they were together. And that was, I think, my only complaint about the show, is that we don't really know who these characters were before the mom passed away. So you don't know how much, you know, that really impacted them. It seems you see it in Fleabag, but, she's been with Barton for, I think they said 10 years, and we don't really get to know, understand why she's, why she likes him, why she loves him, other than like a brief comment that, you know, he makes her laugh. And maybe that's, you know, just the person that she feels like she deserves. But you also don't really understand why, you know, Martin loves or wants to be with her. Like, he seems just as miserable as she does. And they're clearly like not engaging in any sort of romantic relationship, despite the fact that they're together. And it's such a, they're both just completely faking it. I did love the sort of desperation that we saw in him, both when he comes to the cafe to visit Fleabag and begs her not to let Claire leave him. And then again, you know, when he's telling Claire that, or asking Claire to stay with him, and that she doesn't actually want him to leave and all of that. You know, it was good to see his character beyond just being an asshole to either Fleabag or to Claire. But it also just didn't really, I felt like I needed a little bit more context for them and their relationship in order to believe in it.
So for you, it wasn't convincing in the sense of that sometimes people just like get stuck in these bad relationships, which from the outside don't make any sense. It wasn't convincing in the sense of writing wise. It needs to be fleshed out a little bit more.
Yeah, it was more like, I think there needed to be a glimpse into the start of their relationship and why they first fell in love or got together. Because without that, all you see is, you know, him being terrible. Like, there's never, I can't think of one scene in which he's doing something not, you know, dickish. And so it's hard to understand why and what Claire first saw in him. Clearly there must have been something in order for them to, you know, eventually get to this point where they're just staying there out of comfort. But how do you get to that place in the first place?
Yeah, as you said, we're told that he makes her laugh, but I don't think we ever see any examples of that, right, on the show?
No, it's as Fleabag says that, they just sort of cut to Claire laughing, but we don't know why.
Yeah, we're kind of told that but not shown it, I guess. So I guess that would be the one thing where if we could have like an extended length edition of Fleabag, I'd want to see more going into that. And that's a question that I know Phoebe Waller-Bridge has been asked before. And so she gave a quote here along with Sean Clifford where they said, I've been asked a lot, why did she stay with Martin? I think especially for Claire, failure to her is death. If she confronts the truth of her marriage, the man that she's married, she has to have a reckoning with herself that she has failed at something. And I think that's a universal thing that we all live with. It might not manifest in being in a relationship with a man as grotesque as Martin, but I think that we all have blind spots that we don't dare to look at or examine because it means we have to confront something about ourselves that we are just not ready to do. And that makes sense, I think. That kind of tracks with what we know of Claire.
Absolutely. Damn. That was a thoughtful answer from her. I mean, you definitely see that. I know that to be true. Like, she has this image of herself that she doesn't want to, I think, break, of being sort of perfect and successful, and anytime that sort of question, she gets uncomfortable. So yeah, I guess admitting that relationship isn't working to her is a failure, but at the same time, towards the end of season one, she sort of admits that she's unhappy with him and wants to leave him. So clearly, like, she is aware of it to some extent. But I guess it goes back to her not wanting to face that, at least not publicly.
Yeah, there's, I think when we talk about the characters being relatable, that's one way in which maybe Claire relates to more people, or more people relate to Claire rather than they might care to admit. Where with Fleabag, at least early on in the first season, so many of her relationships are very transient, right? It's mm-hmm. one night stand, it's people who just kind of pass through the revolving door of her life. And so you never really get attached to the idea of Fleabag with any one of them, or you don't get to explore that any further. And some of them fall into like familiar archetypes, like the really hot guy who knows that he's really hot, or mm-hmm. Harry, or you can fit them into various buckets. But Claire with Martin, I think a lot of people will either recognize a Martin in their own lives or like know a Claire who's with a Martin, and it always, like, you kind of want to have them to have that reckoning and wake up, but you know that they probably won't, and it's just very uncomfortable to watch that just like stutter on in slow motion from the outside. I think in that sense Claire is very relatable, but she really shouldn't have to be. Like, that's not a good thing.
That's sad. But also I just feel like both Fleabag's father and sister are both in these relationships with people that she absolutely can't stand, and the fact that she's not able to accept those relationships is, you know, distances her from both of them, and is sort of at the end of season one the reason that she sort of spirals towards the end and is even like sort of contemplating jumping in front of a car before she's sort of saved by the lone guy showing up. So I think that those relationships, the way that I at least viewed them in the first season, was more as a way to sort of interfere with her relationships than it was about the characters in themselves, especially with the terrible godmother, because I feel like we actually see her more than we even see the father, because she's sort of always sort of getting in the way and causing, sort of interrupting any sort of connection that she might have with her dad. And Martin kind of serves the same purpose, at least in the first season.
Yeah, what was your take on their father? Because as you say, we don't see that much of him compared to the godmother or some of the other family members. And it's unclear if he's always been fairly distant and fairly reserved, or if that's just a new thing where his new partner is kind of smothering him almost and taking that priority for herself, and he's just left in the shadows instead.
Yeah, it's really hard because, like I was saying before, we don't really know a lot of who these characters are before the mom passed away. So we don't really know if they've always been unhappy and emotionally distant and unable to really talk about their feelings or emotions or their pain. But he in particular is just completely, you know, unable to bear like the pain of, I think, losing his wife, especially, you know, as he relates to his daughters. But it's hard to believe that he had much of a connection with them in the first place. I think especially in the season finale, when she talks to her dad before he gets married, it's very clear that, you know, he sort of sees Fleabag as her mom. It's probably very painful for him to interact with her. But yeah, he's probably, without that final scene where he sort of lays out his motivations, I guess, for being with this other woman who, you know, he sort of can admit to being very annoying and not for everyone. You don't get too much insight into who he is as a character.
So as a brief tangent quickly, you've seen Dead to Me, right?
No, I have not. Just the first episode.
Okay. So without spoiling anything, you have the basic premise there that you have this character whose death or whose loss looms over the entire season, and it defines all of the relationships that all of the other characters have with each other, but you never get to see that character. And so there's something missing where you as a viewer have to fill in the blanks for yourself. And you see that to a lesser extent, but it's still there, I think, with the mother on Fleabag, where you can tell that each of those characters in her family is handling that loss in their own ways, some better than others, but none of them are doing a great job of it. But mm-mm. you never quite get a sense of who this person was who was so important to all of them. And this is the matriarch, I guess, of the same household that produced both Fleabag and Claire, two completely different people. And so mm-hmm. it's hard to come up with this mental image of who this person was and what kind of effect she had on them, what kind of mother she must have been, and you kind of have to fill in that part of the canon by yourself.
Yeah, you really have no idea what the mother was like, other than, you know, Fleabag is the way that she is, according to her father, because of her, which isn't necessarily a negative. In fact, I think that if the show had her there, it would have been a little too overwhelming, or overbearing for the show. But I don't know. I think that it is interesting to sort of think about whether these characters were, like, how different were they before her death, and how much did that really, really impact them? And because it doesn't seem like Claire and her Fleabag had a fantastic relationship beforehand, and it's not really alluded to that she had a great one with her father. In fact, even in the funeral episode, we see her Fleabag's former partner, Harry, I think is his name, come back, and in the first season, when they show sort of the breakdown of that relationship, I felt like it was sort of insinuated that her inability to love and be vulnerable sort of stemmed from the loss of her mom. But it turns out that relationship had, you know, been ongoing even before her mother's death. And when he shows up at the funeral, she's very, it's clear that she's not in any way vulnerable with him. Like, she's the one comforting him. So it's kind of clear that dynamic already existed. So we don't really know, you know, what she was like when her mother was alive.
So let's move on from that to a relationship which I didn't think was going to be relatable at all, but apparently I'm very wrong on that. And that's the Hot Priest, who I don't know if there's been this shared subconscious yearning for a Hot Priest the entire time, if that's something which no one really speaks about, but apparently this is striking a chord with a wide audience here.
Yeah, well, I think that he represents the man or the person that you can't have, that you want, and probably everyone has one of those in their life at some point that they can relate to. This, like, sort of, you just know from the beginning that it's not going to turn out well. But at the same time, the whole time I'm like rooting for Fleabag and this guy, and it's ridiculous.
And in this case, it kind of does work out, but then not really, right? So you get this, will they, won't they, and they almost get there, and you get excited, but you know that it's, because it's Fleabag, it's probably going to end badly somehow, and sure enough, you know. So I think they ride that roller coaster with you pretty well, but it feels like they didn't really need to put any work into establishing that tension, because Andrew Scott just captivated people the moment he arrived on screen, and you know, people were tripping over themselves and wish they were in Fleabag's place instead.
I mean, he's just amazing. I could not get over his performance. He's so intensely lovable, and you don't really know why. Just his personality and I don't know. He's just everything that a priest isn't supposed to be. Something about him just really works, and you can tell that he's very intrigued by Fleabag, and I think as an audience we're all intrigued by her, so we sort of understand his desire to get to know her and get close to her.
I don't know if it was intentional on Phoebe Waller-Bridge's part to not give him a name, so that whenever anyone was raving about him on Twitter months down the line, it would always be as the Hot Priest instead of Martin or whatever like that. Martin sounds not as exciting. The Hot Priest is, you know, an archetype that we can all aspire to, right?
It's true, although a lot of the characters, even Fleabag doesn't really have, we don't know her real name, and a lot of the characters don't, but it works very well in this situation.
Yeah, you don't see people lusting after the bank manager, right? So I guess maybe this is not a universal thing, but I don't know.
Or the bus rodent.
Right, yeah. But the Hot Priest phenomenon seems to have taken hold. And I don't know. I think there's an interesting analysis to be done there, but I don't think I'm qualified to do it.
I think it's also just the absurdity of it. Like, of course, Fleabag falls for a priest. Like, even when she admits this to Claire, like, she just laughs because it's so unexpected yet completely fitting that she would, like, this is the person that she would choose to love again for the first time.
Right. And Phoebe seems to be, or I guess Fleabag instead, seems to be the only other person other than Martin who can make Claire laugh, right? That's, for as angry as Claire gets and as frustrated and for as unrelatable in many ways as she finds Fleabag, she kind of likes her as well, right? Even if she would never admit it, there's some like enjoyment there.
Absolutely. One of my favorite episodes is the one where they go in season one, where they go to the retreat, and on the way there, like, she's just cracking jokes and her sister like breaks down and says, "Don't make this fun," which I just love because it's like she loves Fleabag, but she also at the same time has such a hard time being around her. But it's such an interesting relationship.
Yeah, I think that covers most of the main characters on the show. One, I guess this isn't a character, but more a topic that we really should have covered before because it is everything, is hair. Because this is like a recurring motif where I know Sandra Oh has come out and said that when she started working with Phoebe Waller-Bridge on Killing Eve, Phoebe was obsessed with getting like curly hair in there for some reason, or just like messing with the character's hair, or having that be like this deep symbolic thing that came up over and over again. And I think you can see echoes of that in Killing Eve as well.
That's absolutely amazing. Yeah, that like rant about hair being everything was epic. And I think the series in general touches upon, I guess, not body image, that feels weird to say, but sort of, as Fleabag has sort of this inherent, she places so much value on the way that she looks, and it comes up, like, just random comments about her body and the way that she looks come up across the whole series, that it's clearly something she feels, you know, is important to say. And I love that she says it in such a like absurd way. It's clearly like some weird obsession that she has.
One of my favorite scenes is when they're in the chapel before the funeral, and Fleabag has had her hair done up and she's looking very smart, and every single person just comments on that, and Claire is clearly getting more and more vexed and frustrated, but clearly would never admit that in public because he's Claire. But that, to me, that's an example of how just like a very simple recurring joke can become such a great thing without even trying too hard.
Yes, I love it when she's like, "I keep trying to mess up my hair, but it just keeps falling in this really chic way."
Right. Or when it's one of the early season one episodes where she sees that Claire has plaits and she knows that something must be wrong, you know, because
right.
It's so off-brand for Claire that, you know, there's got to be something deeper. It's just, she finds a way to just like weave that in to where it's not character development, right? It feels silly to call it that, but it does add like this touch of flavor to everything.
I like that you said weave that in. That was a good pun.
That was unintentional. That's just so reflexive by this. I can't escape. I would stop if I could, but I can't. But I think that covers most of the stuff I have down. Are there other just like random observations or just favorite moments, favorite characters that we haven't got to somehow? Just anything else that you want to get off your chest about the show while we're here?
Yeah, I think we didn't really talk too much about the bus rodent, who the first season I thought was one of the most like hilarious characters to have on. He's just like he's like a little puppy dog where he's just so excited that this girl is giving him any attention. She's clearly just completely repulsed by him, yet is so desperate for like validation that she keeps him around and keeps coming back to him. And I guess he's sort of equally guilty of that because she treats him pretty terribly after their date, but he still keeps coming back. And the moment, the scene where they're in the sex shop and he's like so uncomfortable and awkward, and she's just like having the time of her life making jokes that are going completely over his head, was just excellent comedy.
Yeah, I see. This is one of my favorite things about the show is that everybody has their own favorite thing, just like their favorite little moment or favorite minor character who everybody else would agree is good. But that's just one thing that really just is a highlight for them. And I like that somehow within the space of two seasons of six half-hour episodes, she's able to build this universe around herself, around this one woman show that still manages to have all of that depth and variety to it.
Yeah, yeah. I also have a question about season two that I've thought a lot about. What does the fox mean? I don't really... There's a lot of theories out there that I find very funny.
We've moved on from what does the fox say to what does the fox mean? We're getting all...
Yes, what does it mean? Why is it following the priest? No, I've heard different takes that the fox is God, that the fox is doubt, that it's, you know, his relationship with sex. And I don't really know if I find any of those to be true, if it's just, you know, a funny device that they put in the show. But knowing her, it has some sort of intention. But I don't know exactly what that is. Did you have any ideas?
I haven't come across this yet. What's your theory? What's your preferred take on all of this?
If I had to pick something, and I think it's going to make me sound dark, I would say that it's probably supposed to represent his doubts. Or maybe it's like anytime he's starting to sort of wander, this fox shows up and like sets him straight, kind of in the same way that the frames fall or the art falls off the wall whenever he's there's like sort of a blasphemous incident in the air. But I don't know what exactly that means when it follows him at the end. I mean, maybe it's representing his doubt in what he just did. I don't know, but I don't really have any clever theories myself.
I didn't have any clever theories either, although I'm sure the hive mind out there does. You know, when they, if they can take a break from obsessing over the hot priest for just a second, you know, I'm sure we can get something together and figure it out.
The hot priest and the jumpsuit, that's the two things.
The jumpsuit?
That's all everyone else is talking about is the jumpsuit from the first episode.
Oh, I didn't even see anything about this.
Oh, really? That's like all over my Twitter feed. I guess that shows the difference in who we follow.
Different thoughts. So what are the demographics of people who are obsessing over the jumpsuit but not the hot priest?
Well, most of the people talking about the jumpsuit are also obsessing about the hot priest. It seems to be exclusively like women between the age of 30 and 45.
Yeah, see, I don't know if the hot priest has a big gay following or if, you know, he has a wide appeal, but he, with his target demographics, he seems to be lighting it up for sure.
Yeah. It's just so funny because the actor, I always think of him as Moriarty because that's like the only other thing I've seen him in, except I guess now Black Mirror. But he, like, there's nothing, he's so creepy that there's nothing even remotely attractive about him in that. So the juxtaposition is just a little weird for me because he still has like the same, almost the same speech patterns that I don't know. It's weird. When I was watching it, I wasn't like, oh, the hot priest. I was just like, oh, feet, like Fleabag finds his neck really attractive. That's really all that I drew from
okay.
that.
Okay, this jumpsuit. I'm seeing pictures of it now, and yeah, okay. I for some reason, the word jumpsuit just like crossed some wires in my brain or something. But yeah, I can understand why this was a topic of discussion. Let's put it that way.
I'm glad to educate you on female attire.
I mean, every little helps, you know, except as any lessons people are willing to give. But yeah, that jumpsuit is quite something. And I've wondered this for a while now. Like, do you think there's anything that's quintessentially British about Fleabag? Because to me, it feels overwhelmingly British. But I don't know if it would work if you had some like office style American remake of Fleabag. I don't know if it would go down so well.
No, I completely agree. And I don't know, I couldn't even tell you why. There's just something about it that feels so British. I think the sort of her sense of humor is, I don't know if it's it's just quintessentially British. Like, it just wouldn't quite deliver the same punch. And I wouldn't.
I can't quite tell you why, I should be able to. But like Claire as well feels very like the way that Claire is like very buttoned up and restrained feels like it's not just her being Claire. It's her being Claire, and Claire is British, and that's important in that in some way.
Right.
And even the godmother too. There's a very like middle class politeness, which is actually very very passive aggressive beneath the surface. That any British person from a certain background would recognize, I think.
Maybe it's because from, you know, my minimal experience with my British friends, but they always talk about the sort of, I don't know, facade that people put on, that they don't want to talk about their feelings and aren't able to necessarily like express themselves, that like every character in the show has, and it just manifests in a different way. Whereas like, at least culturally, Americans are much more vocal about how they feel and wear their heart on their sleeve and seem to feel fairly free being vulnerable. Obviously not everyone, but that's a little bit more, I don't know, culturally accepted.
Yeah, the hot priest having his accent, I think, is a big part of that too. Like, he's not just a priest. He's not just a hot priest. He's a hot priest that has that specific accent. And if you take away any of those ingredients, I'm not sure how well that recipe comes together.
Right, and just that he's sort of like the apple, right? He's not supposed to be an object of desire, yet he is.
Very much so, according to a lot of people, from what I've seen. but yeah, that... I think that does just about cover anything. Although, again, if you have anything you want to jump in with, then please feel free.
No, I think that's it for me.
All right. If you want people to be following up with you on this, where can they be finding you?
Oh, I am at It's Amy Ann on Twitter. Yeah, come say hi.
And talk about Fleabag. That's really the main... That's why we're all on Twitter, is what I'm taking away from this.
Yes, really, like... I've told so many people in my life to watch the show and they kind of refuse. So Twitter's the only place I have to talk about it, even though it's honestly not as satisfying, but you know, it's what I've got.
You told your friends to watch it and they didn't watch, and then you found new friends, and that's just the circle of life. That's how it goes.
Exactly.
Yeah. So if you want to stay in my good books, you should definitely watch Fleabag. I imagine you have, if you made it this far into a podcast about it, but you never know. So just putting that out of people. But please come and talk to me about it or about anything else. You can find me on Twitter at DomHRB. We will be back with more discussions about various shows, films, documentaries, anything else under the sun. So if you have any suggestions for that, then hit me up again on Twitter or at domandcolin@gmail.com. But thank you for listening here, and we'll talk to all of you again soon. Take care, everyone.